computers, the first mainframes produced by IBM. They were the largest, fastest, and most expensive computers in the world. Each of them contained about 25,000 vacuum tubes and covered about half an acre of floor space. Analog signals from early warning radar sites were converted into digital bits and sent via AT&T's telephone lines to Sage Direction Centers, where the huge computers decided whether an aircraft was friend or foe. If it appeared to be an enemy bomber, the computers automatically sent details about its flight path to the nearest missile batteries and fighter planes. Those details were also sent to NORAD headquarters. Human beings would decide whether or not to shoot down the plane. But that decision would be based on information gathered, sorted, and analyzed by machines. In many respects, Sage created the template for the modern computer industry, introducing technologies that would later become commonplace: analog to digital conversion, data transmission over telephone lines, video monitors, graphic displays, magnetic core memory, duplexing, multiprocessing, large-scale software programming, and the light gun, a handheld early version of the mouse. The attempt to create a defense against Soviet bombers helped to launch a technological revolution. Although dubious about the usefulness of Sage, General LeMay thought that SAC's command and control system needed to be improved as well. He wanted to know where all his planes were at all times, and he wanted to speak with all his base commanders at once if war seemed imminent. It took years to develop those capabilities. When SAC's Strategic Operational Control System, SOCS, was first unveiled in 1950, its teletype messages didn't travel from one base to another with lightning speed. During one early test of the system, they were received almost 5 hours after being sent. And it could take as long as half an hour for the American Telephone and Telegraph Company to make the SOCS circuits operable. That sort of time lag would make it hard to respond promptly to a Soviet attack. Transmission rates gradually improved, and the system enabled LeMay to pick up a special red telephone at SAC headquarters in Omaha, dial a number, gain control of all the circuits, and make an announcement through loudspeakers at every SAC base in the United States. The introduction of single sideband radio later allowed him to establish voice communications with SAC's overseas base commanders and with every one of its bomber pilots mid-air. The amount of information constantly streaming into SAC headquarters from airplanes and air bases throughout the world led to the creation of an automated command and control system that used the same IBM mainframes developed for Sage. The system was supposed to keep track of SAC's bombers in real time as they flew missions. But until the early 1960s, the information displayed at SAC headquarters stubbornly remained anywhere from an hour and a half to 6 hours behind the planes. All of these advances in command and control could prove irrelevant, however, if SAC's commander didn't survive a Soviet first strike. General LeMay's attitude toward civil defense was much the same as his view of air defense. "I don't think I would put that much money into holes in the ground to crawl into," he once said. "I would rather spend more of it on offensive weapons systems to deter war in the first place." Nevertheless, the plans for SAC's new headquarters building included an enormous command bunker. It extended 3 levels underground and could house about 800 people for a couple of weeks. One of its most distinctive features was a wall about 20 feet high, stretching for almost 50 yards, that was covered by charts, graphs, and a map of the world. The map showed the flight paths of SAC bombers. At first, airmen standing on ladders moved the planes by hand. The information was later projected onto movie screens. A long curtain could be opened and closed by remote control, hiding or revealing different portions of the screens. It gave the underground command center a hushed, theatrical feel, with rows of airmen sitting at computer terminals beneath the world map and high-ranking officers observing it from a second-story glass-enclosed balcony. While ordinary families were encouraged to dig fallout shelters in their backyards, America's military and civilian leadership was provided with elaborate, top-secret accommodations. Below the East Wing at the White House, a small bomb shelter had been constructed for President Roosevelt during the Second World War, in case the Nazis attacked Washington, D.C. That shelter was expanded by the Truman administration into an underground complex with 20 rooms. The new bunker could survive the airburst of a 20-kiloton atomic bomb. But the threat of Soviet hydrogen bombs made it seem necessary to move America's commander-in-chief someplace even deeper underground. At Raven Rock Mountain in southern Pennsylvania, about 80 miles from the White House and 6 miles from Camp David, an enormous bunker was dug out of solid granite. Known as Site R, it sat about half a mile inside Raven Rock and another half a mile below the mountain's peak. It had power stations, underground water reservoirs, a small chapel, clusters of three-story buildings set within vast caverns, and enough beds to accommodate 2,000 high-ranking officials from the Pentagon, the State Department, and the National Security Council. Although the bunker was huge, so was the competition for space in it. For years, the Air Force and the other armed services disagreed about who should be allowed to stay there. The president could also find shelter at Mount Weather, a similar facility in the Blue Ridge Mountains near the town of Berryville, Virginia. Nicknamed High Point, the bunker was supposed to ensure the continuity of government. It would house Supreme Court justices and members of the cabinet, as well as hundreds of officials from civilian agencies. In addition to making preparations for martial law, Eisenhower had secretly given 9 prominent citizens the legal authority to run much of American society after a nuclear war. Secretary of Agriculture Ezra Taft Benson had agreed to serve as administrator of the Emergency Food Agency. Harold Beschenstein, the president of the Owens Corning Fiberglass Company, would lead the Emergency Production Agency. Frank Stanton, the president of CBS, would head the Emergency Communications Agency. And Theodore F. Koop, a vice president at CBS, would direct the Emergency Censorship Agency. High Point had its own television studio, from which the latest updates on the war could be broadcast nationwide.